That Great Business Show, Ireland's best business podcast.
Welcome to episode 148 of That Great Business Show, where we bring you all the great tips, insights, and those unique business opportunities, and all perfectly packaged for that healthy walk, with thanks to Dundeal.ie. I'm Conall O'Mora and Fáil Cisteach. On this episode, we know you say you're not interested in what other people earn and that it's none of your business, but, well, you wouldn't mind knowing anyway. There's a new law coming out that's a godsend to the salary curious, and we'll tell you all about it. And you've worked in one sector for most of your life, and then you choose a big change. Why? And what happens? And is it a good idea? Well, a former Derby County professional footballer tells all. All our tips and insights are brought to you thanks to Dundeal Motors. It's the only place to look for your new or previously loved car, van or truck. Dundeal.ie.
Dundeal Motors is home to Ireland's largest range of new and premium used cars. That's why you'll find cars from Audi and BMW dealerships on Dundeal. Are you looking for a 7-seater to accommodate your growing family? Maybe you're after a luxury saloon to make a statement. We have the car for you. You'll also find Ireland's largest range of electric cars to help you make the switch. Visit Dundeal.ie today to start the search for your next car.
Make one small switch. Switching from shaving foam to all-natural De Facto shaving oil will give you the smoothest, softest shave ever. Switching from shaving oil to De Facto helps stop 20 million non-recyclable shaving foam cans go to landfills every year. Switching from shaving oil to De Facto will save your skin, your pocket, and your planet. DeFactoShave.com.
If you have spent 10 years with UPS and 8 years with Crane Worldwide Logistics, it's probably fair to guess that you're most likely going to stay in the logistics business for the rest of your working life. But no. Former Derby County professional footballer Chris Deans has turned his back on a second profession because he has recently become the boss of Portacappin, a business that is synonymous with the building trade across the nation. Chris has been on That Great Business Show twice before because he previously explained to us the supply chain issues from China, the canal blockages in the Panama Canal, and he also told us a fascinating fact about supply trains running from China to Germany and Netherlands, and he's just told me now that they are no more thanks to the Russian-Ukraine war. So, for all of you who wonder, is the grass really greener in some other business or business sector? Well, we had to ask a man who has just decided to take that plunge. Christopher Deans, welcome back to That Great Business Show.
Thank you, and thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Well, believe it or not, you are the top player now on this show because you are the first person to make number three. So, well done you. Okay, the big question. Derby County. tell us what... I've met you twice before. And Brian Clough used to manage Derby County. So I always took an interest in Derby County, the Rams as they're known. And you spent three seasons. And well, what happened?
So it's interesting. It's a long time ago now, but I left school. I'm from Ballymun originally, and I played schoolboy football. And it's fair to say I was a half-decent schoolboy footballer.
You had to be if you made it over to Derby. Yeah. Back then, Derby was
When I signed, we were in the Premier League. And the year I signed, we were relegated to the Championship. I moved over when I was 16. It was a bit of a culture shock because I was obviously from Ballymun, and I was moved to a farm originally because Derby and Derbyshire is kind of renowned for its farmland.
Sheep and the Rams, I presume.
So I lived on a farm for a period of time. I actually moved over with a guy from Ringsend, a guy called David Cassidy, who's still involved in football at some capacity. So I spent a number of years there, and it was actually really, really good. But I mean, ultimately in the end, in hindsight, it didn't work out. I wasn't good enough.
It really is tough.
And you think of it, in the period of time that I was there, like when I signed, we had a youth team that was 18 in that squad. And then the next year, another 18, and the next year. So the conveyor belt was massive. I mean, yes, you've got to have a little bit of luck, but you've got to be good enough as well, you know, and the gap is massive.
You see it in professional rugby as well. Kids brought in, nurtured, dumped.
Yeah.
It's tough.
And I think that's brutal. Like, it's funny you say that, because that was kind of fundamentally what kind of has driven me ever since. So I
lovely segue. Yeah, talk to me.
So when I was let go, I'll never forget it as long as I live. It was the 18th of March. I was on crutches and I was called into the office. And you kind of...
Had you broken something?
I had torn me medial ligament in my right knee.
That is so hurt.
Yeah. And I was kind of on the mend coming back. But then they called me in, and you kind of have an inkling. Your contract is up. You finish, the season is over in May. You're officially contracted till the end of June. And I was called in, and ultimately it was just, you're told no. And you go from being wrapped in cotton wool and being treated as this kind of next big superstar to what you have to you're gone. You're on a one-way ticket back. And I was in the moment, I remember going out and after calling me mum, and I just said, look, it's not happening, it's over. And she was kind of going, oh, right. And it was only when I was saying the words, because I walked out of the building and walked around beside. It was only when I said the words, I thought, for as long as I live, I'll never forget this feeling, number one. And for as long as I live, I won't let, this will drive me forward as opposed to push me down a road where I don't want to go. And ultimately, it was that kind of drive that has kind of driven me ever since. Because I know what it's like to come home at 20 years of age with nothing. You go away with so much hope and you come back with absolutely nothing.
And you then go off into the logistics business.
Yeah, and it's funny because I came back, I obviously went I did a little bit of sports science in the UK. But when I came back, I didn't know what I wanted to do. If honestly, I didn't really want to do anything.
I don't think there are many 20-year-olds who actually know what they want to do anyway.
But I didn't do a leaving cert, so I'd done the equivalent of A-levels in the US or in the UK. But I didn't have any kind of aspiration to do anything. I played semi-professional. It was with Dublin City at the time, but that was kind of two or three evenings a week. So my days were filled with either going to gym and I kind of lost my way a little bit, I'd say, for about 4 or 5 months. I kind of did what most young 20-year-olds do, but I just kind of went a little bit haywire. And it was actually my mum that said to me, I think it was in around the September time, that you're going to have to either figure out what you want to do or you're going to have to move out, type of thing. So I kind of, UPS were next to where my mum lives, and my mum's from in Poppentry and Ballymun, and UPS are still there. And I applied for a job that I didn't know what I was applying for, and I got it. It was a cold calling role in an office, and I went in with that, and I kind of developed all the way through for 11 years, as you touched on earlier on.
And then you went to Crane, where you ended up, because that's when you were with us twice.
Yeah.
You became the European manager or European...
Head of sales for Europe, Middle East and Africa.
Yeah. Which is no mean feat.
Yeah, and so ultimately, the UPS journey took me to head of sales and marketing for Ireland, and then I got to a stage where there was kind of, I was on this development program, if you want to call it that, or I was looked at as a kind of a high potential. But they wanted me to relocate. I had a young daughter, and it just wasn't feasible. So I went into Crane as the MD of Ireland first, and I spent about 4 years in that role, and that was a really, really enjoyable role. And that's relevant to the role I'm in now, so that I'll come back to that. But then just through the pandemic, I was promoted into head of sales for Europe, Middle East and Africa, which was a really, really dynamic, interesting role. The region was really vast. The company is incredible, is on a fantastic growth journey. And the travel was extensive, right? So it came to a stage in my personal career where I was looking at, in both personal career and kind of personal life, did I want to be the next 5 or 6 years traveling?
That is a big question.
It is.
Some people love it. I had to travel when I was working, say, in stockbroking. I didn't want to do it. I don't particularly like airports or airplanes or hotels. I'm happy to sell.
Yeah,
but not the other bits.
And initially, I mean, the travel initially is like, you talk to a lot of people and they say, oh my God, like I've been in Qatar just before the World Cup. Yeah. I'm seeing all these fantastic stadiums and you're in South Africa and you're in these amazing places, but you could be in a hotel down the road. Like, I mean, all you're seeing is an airport, a boardroom, a restaurant and a hotel. So it was good, but it can wear you down and wear you thin. Although the role was incredible and the company's fantastic, there was just a huge drain. You're just tired all the time and you're missing out on so much, and your personal life quality kind of dwindles a little bit.
And the grass was greener elsewhere. So, because I'm going to move you quickly along to Portacabin. Everybody, including me, knows the Portacabin name. It's like Hoover to to a Hoover, Porta Cabin to Porta Cabin.
Yeah, and I think the Porta Cabin, the name and the brand and the company name and the brand is trademarked, and it's a really interesting and dynamic brand. And what I wanted to, why I ended up in Porta Cabin was I didn't want my career to stall, number one, and I wanted to get back into the kind of the business management and the P&L responsibility and being part of something that's exciting and real. And it, like throughout the kind of the 4 months that I engaged with Porta Cabin Limited in relation to taking over the role, the engagements and the conversations were just incredibly fascinating. And the business and the dynamic of the business was something that just kind of gripped me.
But you may as well be talking about, I don't know, bar work versus, I'm trying to think of something, law work. I can't see any connection between Porta Cabin and logistics.
Yeah, and you're right, there's none in terms of like-for-like industries, there's absolutely none. But part of there's a number of different reasons why I chose the career change. One was, I was at a stage where I was starting to get pigeonholed into a senior commercially focused logistics professional. So,
and what would that have meant for you? You could have spent the next 20 years.
I've been approached for a couple of roles while I was in Crane, and the roles were either VP of sales or global head of sales. And they were all very senior commercially focused roles, which is fantastic and very flattering to be considered for. But what I wanted to do, I got a better buzz out of, I'm a real people person, a real team person. I got a better buzz out of leading a business and leading a team. I wanted to step out of my comfort zone initially and get back into an industry where I knew nothing about, but the leadership skills that I developed over the years were transferable.
And did you learn anything out of football for that leadership?
Yeah, so the type of leader I am is, like, I wasn't, when I look at it now, and I've been brutally honest, I wasn't the best footballer.
You're a centre back, and for those who don't know football, you are effectively an enforcer.
Yeah, and I was I was definitely the enforcer. I'd have a huge disciplinary problem in terms of football. But I knew
that transferred to business.
but why it transferred to business was because I knew the importance of an individual brings to a team, right? So I knew that I was never a best individual player, so I was never going to be able to do anything alone. So when I lead organisations, when I lead Crane and all the management roles I'm in, I've surrounded myself with good people because ultimately I'm only a cog in a wheel. So I was involved with professional sport, and that gave me the kind of grounding to say, you're going to need people around you. You cannot do this alone. And that was a mantra that I just take forward in all of the roles, because if you've got the right people and the right people around you, you can't go far wrong. And if everyone is together, like in any good sports team, the teamwork is key.
Tell me a bit about Porta Cabin, because I actually thought before I looked it up that it was an Irish company, but it's a UK company.
Yeah, so we're a privately owned UK company headquartered in York.
And it's huge.
We're massive. And we've got Porta Cabin Limited here in Ireland. We're in Donabate, which kind of 90% of the workforce is. We've also got a facility in Belfast, which services the north. We're in Galway and we're in Cork. And we're involved, like, it's a really interesting dynamic business, because a lot of people's perception of Porta Cabin is, or Porta Cabin buildings would be like some of the security huts, or when you go onto building sites, some of the canteens and stuff. Our Porta Cabin units on those particular sites, like the building sites, that's one part of our business, right? So we've got our we've got a huge part of our business that is involved with the construction element. We also are heavily involved with schools and classroom builds. We're heavily involved in healthcare. We're heavily involved in sport and recreational. So we're just so vast across all of these different industries, massive in terms of some of these big healthcare companies now, in terms of a lot of the office space we do for these guys. And it was just, the more I looked at the business and the more I look at the business in 6 weeks in, the opportunity is endless. I mean, in this country alone.
But you say the opportunity is endless. There are many competitors.
Yeah.
And you're manufacturing in the UK. So it's actually a sales operation here, really, isn't it?
Well, we do. We manufacture the shell of the buildings in the UK. What we do is we do our own modifications and fit outs and installs here locally. Like, I'll give you an example in terms of manufacturing in the UK. We've got a lot of the shell of the buildings ready to go, so we could have a classroom standing with groundworks done in 6 weeks. So if a school or Department of Education come on to us tomorrow, within 6 weeks we could have a classroom standing.
Okay, which means, and I don't know, I didn't ask you this, is, have you got involved in emergency housing or anything like that? I mean, could you sort out 1,000 or a couple of 5,000 houses overnight?
Right now, we're not in the residential area because
this in UK or in Ireland?
In across the group. And I think there's a lot of legislation areas there that I won't go down, but there's some kind of sticking points in around the buildings and our compatibility for residential.
I thought we were onto a fix for the property problem, but obviously not.
No, there's a little bit of red tape to come over there, yeah.
And the Brexit must be a problem for you.
Yes and no. I think from our point of view, we've got a lot of the buildings. We're a core hire business, so a lot of the buildings we have on hire, and then we have a stock of ready-made buildings available to
you're
us.
Ah, a hire business.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And do you finance that by any chance? In other words, are you kind of a bit of a bank as well?
So essentially what we do is let's take the prime example of somebody wants one of our modular buildings in an office space and they want the lease agreement. They only need it for a 3-year period. We would lease it to them over the 3 years on a payment plan, yeah. Essentially.
So effectively you are a bank.
Well,
kind of.
I've never looked at it like that.
Tell me about some of the sales opportunities if you're 26 counties, because are you in charge of Belfast as well?
Yeah, Belfast comes under the Island of Ireland in terms of management, yeah. So we've got opportunities across all sectors. We've got some in the educational sector where we're talking and we're deeply, really far down the road in terms of some really big school projects. Some of the big multinational pharmaceutical companies, we are involved with those in terms of creating a huge amount of office space and
that must be temporary though. I mean, is this why they're building or?
Yes, a lot of our, so we're modular buildings, right? So a lot of them are 3, 5, 7 year kind of lease agreements. Now in saying that, a lot of the solutions we provide would run longer than initially planned. From our customers' point of view, they like what they see. You go into our buildings, there is almost like a hard standing building, so you wouldn't know the difference between modular. And they just kind of let them run on. So, but generally they come to our company, Portacam Limited, for kind of a short to medium term solution.
There are, as I mentioned, rivals. What do they do better than you do?
If I'm brutally honest, and I'm 6 weeks in, I know the names of some of the competitors, but I don't really concentrate too much on what our competition can do. I think what I'm more kind of concerned about is how can we be better? How can we service the needs of our customers better?
I had a boss called Frank Shanley 1,000 years ago, and that's what he taught me. He used a euphemism, a bold word about the competition. He said, "Don't bother with them. Concentrate on your own business."
Yeah, I think you need to understand the market, you need to understand the competition, but I think you've got to understand the value that a Portacam building can bring to the market. And I think if we stand over our core values and principles, we've got a really recognisable brand in the marketplace. We've got a really good market share.
When they were signing you, what did you promise them? Double the turnover in 2 years or quadruple or?
Well, I think, I mean, for me, there was two things. One, we have an opportunity, like we've got a good chunk of the market share here in Ireland, but there's so much to go after. So it's to continue the good work in terms of the growth of the company. But more importantly, and I think it was, to me, coming into this role was an opportunity to create a culture where we were very people focused, because I've been in situations in the past where companies were starting to sacrifice the people for the sake of the number, and it just didn't sit well with me. So I kind of came into this with a kind of fresh mindset to say we'll put our people first, and ultimately we'll become one of the best places to work and attract the best people.
Perfect segue, because I was going to ask you, because nobody can find anybody to hire anymore. How are you doing, and how are you doing it if you are finding people?
Well, I think two things. One is the people we have in the business. We've got some incredibly well-educated, well-rounded, like rock stars, I'd want to call them, in the business.
How many?
We have 104 staff in Ireland and a number of vacancies as well. The second part of that is attracting the right people is really, really difficult. Because if you look at our business, it's commercial, there's marketing, there's finance, there's architectural, there's design and engineering, there's trades people. So it is really, really difficult.
So how are you going to do it?
Well, I think that the upside of it is just twofold. We've got fantastic people who've been in the company a long time, so they're a testament to how well we treat our staff, number one. Number two is create a culture and an environment where people enjoy coming to work, because, as I said, we've got a really good, there's no egos or no hierarchy in the organisation. We're all very transparent and open. And coming from professional sport, I had a big ego, so I know what it's like to be one of those egocentric people. So we have a very open culture that respects people's home lives as well, so that we've got a good work-life balance, and it's important that people come to work safe and go home safe. So we just try and create the right environment, the right culture. We will talk to the people. It's just a matter of convincing them that Power Cabin Limited is the business for them.
And when you talk, can you be a tough talker? You can, of course.
Yeah. I think, like, in the role I'm in, like, there's decisions that need to be made that are not necessarily favourable all the time, and not necessarily.
Do you remember when they let you go? Yeah. You said you'd never do that again.
Yeah.
Well, and that's, are you doing that now?
Well, I think I'm not doing it now. I think there's a huge amount of empathy in the type of leadership that I try and bring. At the end of the day, we all have families, and people are human beings at the end of the day. However, on the flip side of that, we've got to look at the business and what's right for the business. And either if we have to make tough decisions based on what's right for the overall strength of the business moving forward. And we've got to somewhat remove any kind of personal connection or emotion we have.
So at the moment, 6 weeks in, good choice.
Yeah,
and would
really
you recommend
good.
To people to make a big pivot?
Yeah, I would. I think for me, the big thing was if you're going to learn, there's no better way to learn than stepping right out of your comfort zone. And that's what I chose to do. I stepped right out of the comfort zone. I'm asking a lot of silly questions in a lot of meetings. But the dynamic, it's a new set of eyes on the business, and it just gives you a whole new breadth of perspective.
And you hop out of bed in the morning?
Yeah, I enjoy going to work. And in fairness, I always did enjoy going to work, but this just gives me, an extra bounce, because I have an opportunity now to make a difference in people's lives consciously now.
Today, Ireland, tomorrow, the world?
Well, you never say never, really, you know.
I know where you're heading. Final question, always ask you, hire in a heartbeat. Who is Christine's hire in a heartbeat?
Well, I did do a couple of people.
Okay, that's hilarious.
And I still stand over to kind of the Richard Branson one. I think he is just like an incredible human being. He's one of these guys.
Did he call you since? No.
No, he hasn't. No. He sparks an idea, and then he just creates these amazing business models out of an idea. And then I had listened to an interview recently with a guy called Phil Giles, who's the director of football at Brentford Football Club. He was on one of those high performance podcasts, and he came from a non-sporting background, and his
with a name like Giles,
yeah, you would have thought. But his perspective of the interview was fascinating. The guy sounded really, really incredible.
And have you met him, or have you?
I've not met him, but we Porter Cabin buildings are the Brentford training ground facility, so we are in the process of trying to set something up.
That makes sense to me. Phil Giles is a man who needs to see you. He wants to see you. Christine, listen, before I let you go, anything huge happening in the logistics business that we should know about? Is it all settled down now?
Well, I think the market is. I think at the start of the year, it settled and capacity became back available. It's kind of settled down now a little bit. Obviously, the rail out of Asia was hugely disrupted with the tragedies that's going on in the Ukraine and Russia. So that was kind of shelved a little bit. But it seems to have settled. To be honest, when I stepped out of it in around Easter time, I've not really kind of looked back in.
I was going to say, you don't care.
Yeah.
Christine, CEO, Porter Cabin Ireland, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business
thank
Show.
Thank you.
Dundeal Motors is home to Ireland's largest range of new and premium used cars. That's why you'll find cars from Audi and BMW dealerships on Dundeal. Are you looking for a 7-seater to accommodate your growing family? Maybe you're after a luxury saloon to make a statement. We have the car for you. You'll also find Ireland's largest range of electric cars to help you make the switch. Visit dundeal.ie today. to start the search for your next car.
All that great business show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
Did you know there's such a thing as the National Jealousy Day? On the 1st of November every year, Finland publishes the taxable income of all of its citizens. According to one Finnish person I saw quoted, it's described as an annual orgy of financial voyeurism that remains an important national event in Finland. But did you know that an EU directive, the EU Pay Transparency Directive, that has been recently passed, means your income, roughly, will be made public knowledge by law. Organizations will be required to provide information on pay as part of the recruitment process and will no longer be able to ask candidates about current pay to determine offers. And employers with more than 50 workers must provide workers with information on what criteria are used to determine pay and pay progression. Mike McDonough is COO of Sigmar Recruitment, and he wants to share his pay band with us. Mike McDonough, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thanks, Connell. Thanks for having me.
You've got an interesting job because you're allowed to sit down and read the EU Pay Directive, Transparency Directive, should I say.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've read it cover to cover. Absolutely.
And riveting stuff it is, too. Yeah. Because for those who want to remain secretive about their pay, well, the gig is all over.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting that this is coming in Europe. Obviously, the legislation is there. It's going to take a while to come into effect. But this has actually been happening in the States over the last 5 years.
You just said this to me, yeah. And I was really surprised because, yeah, I would have thought America, the land of the free, the land of tell nothing.
That's it, exactly. You would think so. But they've actually been pioneering sort of pay transparency. I think it began in Massachusetts in 2018, actually. They had an Equal Pay Act, which basically meant that companies were not allowed to ask prospective employees what their salaries were. So that's part of the EU directive. And when you think about that, you kind of go, that's actually, maybe it's a bit OTT, you know, that you're not allowed to ask somebody what their salary is. You know, what's the harm in that? But actually what it has done, or what it seems to have done with organizations there, is they're now starting to pay people for the role that they're going for rather than paying people for the role that they had. And there's a subtle but very important difference there, is that we're now looking at what's the pay for this role rather than what's the pay that I used to have.
You have been in recruitment a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You have climbed the greasy pole. You know every trick in the book. There are ways of finding out people's pay without actually asking them,
yeah.
I am sure.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, yeah, yeah. I wouldn't like to reveal any of the tricks. No, there's no. But I think what's really good about this is transparency around pay is really important. You know, we know that organisations that advertise jobs when they have pay on their adverts get better applications.
By how much?
Probably 20-30%. I mean, it depends on the type of job it is, but yeah, about 20-30% better applications, or more applications that are stickier as well, because those people are not, you know, the tire kickers who are just flinging their CV out to anything. You know, if you see a salary and you go, okay, that's not enough for me, you may not apply, but that's okay, because better that you do that at that stage than later on down the line. But if you see the application, you like the look of the job and the salary is within the sort of range that you're looking for, you think that's commensurate with the job, which is really important. Again, it's about the job, not your previous job. I think those applications are stickier. They're more likely to go through to offer stage. And that's got to be better for everybody, the candidates, the organizations as well.
Will I know that Mike McDonough, who's an engineer, say, with Pfizer, mm-hmm. I will be able to, he's my next door neighbor, I'll be able to know how much he's on?
So I don't know exactly how the legislation is going to be implemented, but the way it works in the States, so they have pay transparency laws now in places like California, New York, Washington, and it's really interesting what they're doing there. So they're compelling organizations to put in pay bans for different types of roles and different levels.
And is it really wide? I mean, 50 to 250,000.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think they'd get away with that, to be honest with you, because I think that would be probably stretching things a little bit. But yeah, I think what they're compelling organizations to do is provide those pay bans so that, you know, there's more clarity, there's more transparency around what people should be paid in different roles in different organizations for different skills. And yeah, so theoretically, you will know what your neighbor is being paid, or roughly what sort of pay band they're in. And one of the outcomes of this, which is So important.
Is jealousy.
Well, jealousy, yeah, you've got the National Jealousy Day in Finland. But no, I think we're starting to get more equity around pay, which is a huge issue, obviously, when we look at sort of the gender pay gap, which we've got coming in next year in Ireland. So there's going to be a compulsion for organisations to report if you've more than 250 employees. And we know that there is a gender pay gap and that needs to be sorted. So I think this will help with that. But in the States, they're seeing that that gender pay gap is being addressed to a certain degree due to the pay transparency. But also you've got people in minorities who are also experiencing a pay gap as well. So people in different minority groups are getting paid less for exactly the same job as somebody who's not in one of those minority groups. And again, in the US, what they have seen, and again, it's still early days. A lot of the legislation in the States is only coming through in the last sort of 12, 18 months, I believe. But it's starting to address some of those pay inequalities. And that can only be a good thing.
Well, take a company, we'll call it the Acme organization, which is 250 employees. Are they obliged to put onto their website or wherever the bans? Somewhere public?
I don't know. So, yeah, again, I don't know whether they're obliged to publish all of their pay bans, but when they advertise a job, they have to put the salary on the job.
Will that put people off applying. Advertising? Well, I presume applying it. You've just answered that by saying that's within my expectations, so I will apply.
Yeah.
But the other side of it, will employers try to find ways around it? I don't know how they'll do it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they will. But I think, though, you know, these days, you know, information about companies is so much more easy to find. So transparency is such a key issue for organizations. And I think any companies that try and get around this, it'll be very clear and very obvious and they'll get sort of called out very quickly. So I don't think that's going to be in their best interest.
But if you put down 50,000 plus huge benefits, I mean...
I think, again, what we see in the States, the way the legislation is actually being implemented is you have to put, you know, the banding of the basic salary. And then obviously, if there are benefits on top, you can describe them as you wish, I think. And obviously, things like bonuses and things like that can be obviously variable depending on performance of individuals, depending on performance of the organization. So maybe companies will start to be a little bit cute around things like that. But again, you know, if you think about, you know, these days, you can go onto Glassdoor and you can read reviews of organizations and what they are like and what really happens kind of behind closed doors. So
I never even thought of asking you about Glassdoor.
Yeah.
Do you use it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you believe the comments of people or do you just your filter?
No, I think you've got to use a filter. You know, obviously, if you take the premise that bad news travels faster than good news, then, you know, so that you sort of take a bit of a pinch of salt on some of that. But equally, if you start to see a pattern, I think it's a bit like TripAdvisor, isn't it? You know, if you see a pattern around the same kind of stories coming up around the same sort of organizations, it might make you think, okay. I mean, we certainly look at it for our own organization in Sigmar and think, okay, what's the kind of public image that we're projecting via Glassdoor? What are people saying about us?
What did they say?
Hopefully very good things on the whole. But if people have got things that they're not happy about, then we try and address them and we do invite those people to engage with us directly. And I think organizations that are good at this and that really kind of actively manage their employer brand, you know, they invite all kinds of feedback. And when they get negative feedback, they want to try and take it on and go, okay, what do we do about this? And maybe there's grievances that people have that are legitimate. And sometimes there's grievances that people have that aren't legitimate and they can be addressed maybe offline. But ultimately you see some companies that are very active on those kind of platforms. They're very transparent. They want, you know, there to be, you know, sort of no secrets there so that, you know, when people come to apply to their organizations, what they see online around the kind of information that they portray is very, very authentic to what they then feel and experience when they go into a company. Because again, if we think about things like retention in, you know, employment and the recruitment circles, that's a big issue, is that companies can project a wonderful image online of, you know, being a great organization and very, very caring. But then, you know, day one, they don't get spoken to by anybody. And, you know, you sort of get given a, you know, an online module to go and plug yourself into for 2 days, you know, and the actual experience isn't authentic to what you've seen. That can often create that sort of fracture very early on that causes issues around retention.
If I am trying to sell a house or a car or anything, I always have to put up a price because that thing, infrequently you will see POA, price on application. Why do employers continue not to put up their salaries. I mean, it's they're going to be the salary. They're hardly going to deviate by 100,000 quid or something. It's the salary.
Yeah, I don't know, Connell, to be honest. It's something that we do advise companies to be transparent about. And we say, look, put the information out there. Unless you've got something to be concerned about, put it out there, because you will get better applications, stickier applications, as I said.
What could those concerns be?
I think it might be if they do have a lot of variability at certain, you know, in certain roles around salary. And you can understand sometimes why that happens, you know, so, you know, if they have to, you know, fight to keep hold of certain members of staff, if they're a small organization and they, you know, they're worried about, you know, the kind of jealousy that might happen in an organization, or he's getting paid more than I am and this kind of stuff.
But isn't that the whole point of this?
Absolutely, it is. Yeah. But I think, so again, what we look at, you know, reading the sort of research and the kind of what they've experienced in the US with this, with the pay transparency, is that actually some of what this legislation is bringing in might seem like a real threat to organizations, but actually what it does is it almost sort of gives them that sort of sense of, okay, we've just got to rip the plaster off here, put the pay bands in place, make it public when we need to, which is when we're advertising. And we then start to sort of hopefully manage those, you know, pay conversations in a more structured way, annual pay conversations, not the one-off bits and the death by a thousand cuts that you can get, which happens in organizations. And sometimes you have to do that. But I think this is one of the outcomes that we've seen from what's been happening in the US.
I'm hearing that this is going to make your life and your job much easier.
Well, a recruiter's job is pretty tough, to be honest with you, Connell. So yeah, I know. There's a violin somewhere going off, isn't there, I think. It would be really interesting to see what happens. And I think it will
make...
Well,
it cuts out a lot of the rubbish conversations of being, this is the salary now.
Yeah,
so
yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it does, it makes that clarity around the salary, and that's the band, that's as far as... I mean, you see it in public sector, you know, they're very, very clear. And when we work with public sector clients, you know, it's very, very clear, that's the top end of the scale. There's no going past that. You know, there's no bonuses if it's a certain type of organization. And that just, it does cut out a lot of those conversations where it's, well, maybe I'll have a chat with them. No, there's no having a chat with them. That's the band, you know?
Which makes your life easier.
It might make it a little bit simpler, yes.
Which means easier, you're going to take a pay cut, remember?
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that. Yeah.
What is it like trying to recruit in an economy where there is nigh on full employment?
Yeah, it's very tough. Yeah, it's very tough. You know, as organizations, again, when we're guiding organizations about how they should present themselves to the market, you have to do a lot of work to, I suppose, tell a story to people. You know, so why would I? And because candidates now, because there's full employment, they have to leave somewhere else in order to come and decide to join you. So why would I leave there? What's going to compel me to come and leave my organization where I'm probably, maybe I'm okay, I'm happy enough. Maybe I'm a 7 out of 10. I might come to you for an 8.5 out of 10. Or a 9 out of 10, but like, what is it that's going to compel me? And that storytelling piece is really important.
And what is working at the moment? Trying to poach, call it what you will, trying to move people. What are they buying into?
They're buying into things like, well, actually, table stakes are things like flexibility. That's not a perk anymore. That's almost considered,
3 day week.
3 day week, 3 day as in three in the office, 3 days
office
a week
type of thing. Sorry,
I was kind of thinking you're going to like the 4 day week.
We'll
3 day
week's a
bit radical.
Second.
Yeah.
But is that one of the things that there is just no discussion anymore? People want to spend some time at home.
I think they want flexibility. Yeah. So, however that can happen in your organization, again, some companies are able to give that more than others because of the nature of what they do. But I think organizations have to offer some element of flexibility. They have to try and listen to the individual, and it's very much the individual conversation around what are your particular needs. So if I'm looking to acquire your skills, what's happening in your life that I need to try and understand so I can try and offer some flexibility? Now, it's not that I go all the way over to your side of the table, but at least we have that conversation. We try and, you know, and I think when companies are recruiting, if they're having those types of conversations, that's a very positive place to be. But that's kind of, like I say, that's sort of table stakes. That's not really even a perk anymore. You know, that's just understood. That's what will be the conversation. If you're not having those conversations, it's really tough.
5 day week in the office, is it all over?
I don't think so, no. I think, again, some people are doing that by choice. I would be in the office pretty much 5 days a week by choice. You know, my organization lets us work from home if we want to and have flexibility, but
so
I prefer
why do you
it.
Choose that?
I prefer the social side of work, to be honest with you. I like the energy. I like the buzz that I get off my colleagues in the office. I like going out to meet clients. I like being able to go and buy a sandwich, you know, and sort of be more active when I'm away from home. And then home is just home. You know, I like the fact that I can go work from home when I want to. But I choose that option of going into town and enjoying the kind of the active piece of going to work. And I suppose I'm a bit of a dinosaur as well, I suppose.
I mentioned the 3-day week. What I actually meant was a 3-day flexible week.
Yeah.
A 4-day week, though, does look like it's beginning at the very, very early stages, but that the 4-day week is coming upon us at some
Definitely.
Stage.
Yeah, I think it is. It's gaining a little bit of momentum. And it's interesting, again, how companies actually implement that, though. So do they do it as just a 4-day week, as in you work your normal hours, you get your normal pay, but you just don't have to work on a Friday or a Monday or whatever it might be.
Are there companies that you deal with that or have already implemented that? Or
One or two, yeah. Okay. Well, but typically what they're doing is 5 days over 4. So the hours are extended a small bit. And then so their employees have been asked to work the hours over 4 days rather than 5, or probably maybe like 4.5 days over 4, something like that. So that's typically what happens. Now, the problem is the devil's in the detail. Some companies, they really mean it when they say 4-day week, and you don't get a phone call, you don't get an email on that day that you're not working. Some other companies would like to think that they mean a 4-day week, and you're still on call on that 5th day. So it's, again, how it's implemented, what's the detail. I think candidates looking at companies that are doing that have to really sort of pick away at the detail of how does that actually work? What's the experience like for people?
I presume also that must mean at what level you are at. I mean, if you are in the C-suite that you guys like to talk about, when you're up at the top, you've got to take a phone call or an email whenever.
But I think, though, you've got to show leadership, though. I mean, if you're an organization that's committed to a 4-day week and you're the C-level or director level, whatever it might be, if you start to slip, then you're kind of encouraging other people to do that, I think, in a sort of almost a flip way thinking about it there, Connell. So I think, you know, if you're an organization that's genuinely committed to it and you've got the right structures in place to sort of manage the business and manage your customers, maybe, as a, you know, whether you're a director or whether you're somebody who just joined the job on an internship, the same rules have to apply and leadership has to show leadership.
Entrepreneurs never stop.
Yeah.
Sundays, mornings, nights, makes no difference. If you are a truly entrepreneurial organization, surely days, weeks, hours, they just all merge into one.
Yeah, some people definitely will have espoused that kind of life and that kind of work life. But I think entrepreneurs do their work when they need to as well. You know, so there's also that other side of things is that an entrepreneur will work when they need to, and then they don't work when they don't need to.
I haven't met those ones.
There's a few of them out there. Yeah. And I think they're smart about it. You know, presenteeism isn't important to them. You know, they don't care how long people are in the office. They're going, get the results. You know, if you can do that by 4 o'clock on a Thursday and you don't need to be in the office on a Friday, I don't mind. And I think there's people out there that that have that kind of philosophy. I think it's really refreshing. And I think in those organizations where you can be very clear about performance, and you've got very, very clear transparency around performance, if you can provide that kind of flexibility, that's really interesting as well. It's a lot of trust and a lot of transparency again.
Come back to the idea, which is fantastic, that we have near full employment or as close as we can be, I'd say. Any little warning signs that you're concerned about? Anything that you've seen recently?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots going on. It's a very confusing marketplace, to be honest with you, at the moment, Connell. You know, so recruitment globally has been sort of slowing down. Now it's still at a decent level. And again, because you've got full employment, you have that sort of that talent gap. So that is an issue. You know, an organization's being a little bit less kind of sharp on their recruitment practices because they think that there's more talent out in the market because they're hearing that people are making redundancies. It's not actually the case. In fact, they have to be sharper and they have to continue to sort of sharpen that axe.
But there are redundancies. So therefore, surely, if you see that X company is letting people go, you can go straight on to them, no?
You can. And I think what's really interesting is some of those organizations have published lists of their, you know, the people that they've made redundant and, you know, try to really sort of actively help those individuals get, you know, a new job, which I think is great. But I think, you know, a lot of those, I mean, we're talking about some of the high profile redundancies that have happened in Ireland. Thankfully, a lot of those individuals have been snapped up by the market. And that was a really important thing because there was a lot of great talent there that was let go and very sad to see. But I think, you know, so that's an issue that talent is still going to be, you know, a shortage. A couple of other issues, I think, skills and the acquisition of skills and how organizations enable people to acquire new skills. So again, you know, AI is a huge thing at the moment and how organizations look to try and harness that, use it in their organizations. But how do we sort of, you know, help our people acquire those skills so that they can continue to sort of develop and be flexible in our organizations rather than leaving to go somewhere else? So that skills acquisition piece is going to be really, really important. But the other thing we talked about as well, which was the sort of hybrid work thing, the pressure that that's putting on workers, both, you know, sort of at the bottom level of organizations, so to speak, but also in kind of leadership or management roles. That is, I think, a ticking time bomb. Things like loneliness, you know, sort of well-being in a general sense, but loneliness in a very specific sense. People working from home who think it's great, but actually it's not doing them an awful lot of good. And I do worry about that as a bit of a, that's something in the post for organizations. And how do we deal with that? I don't know the answer, to be honest with you, before you ask me. but I think that's something that, you know, businesses have got to think about.
Now, you want the job, but I can't give you the job because, yeah, you know what? You didn't read your email.
Oh, I know. Yeah, you got me at the start here. Sorry about that.
Hire in a heartbeat. It's written at the top of the email. He didn't read it.
Well, there was a few heartbeats since you asked me, though.
Mr. So I McDonough, you're not getting the job, but who would you, Mike McDonough, hire in a heartbeat?
Who would I hire in a heartbeat? So I'm a big fanboy of behavioral science. And the man who is, I suppose, one of the biggest exponents of behavioral science and behavioral economics, Dr. Pete Lunn, the ESRI. I'd hire him in a heartbeat. I'd settle for probably an hour over coffee or something to have a chat with him. I just think he's fascinating, his view on the world.
We might actually have him in. He's with our ESRI, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
well, we might have a chat with him. I don't know him. I haven't heard of him.
Yeah.
But I think we might hire him.
Yeah.
Good choice.
Thank you.
You have redeemed yourself.
Thanks very much.
We'll have a second interview.
Very good.
That is Mike McDonough, Chief Operating Officer at Sigmar Recruitment. Thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Dundeal Motors is home to Ireland's largest range of new and premium used cars. That's why you'll find cars from Audi and BMW dealerships on Dundeal. Are you looking for a 7-seater to accommodate your growing family? Maybe you're after a luxury saloon to make a statement. We have the car for you. You'll also find Ireland's largest range of electric cars to help you make the switch. Visit dundeal.ie today to start the search for your next car.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. DeFacto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why DeFacto leaves your face, underarms or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. DeFacto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 148. Great business insights and inspiration, all thanks to our sponsor, Dundeal.ie. It's the only place to find your next car, new or secondhand. Sign up for email updates and for your own personal copy of the podcast at thatgreatbusinessshow.com. And that is where to go if you would like to advertise with us. We record at the Dublin South Podcast Studios, where Terry, what you see is what you get, Brock, is today's sound engineer, while the fully transparent studio manager and engineer supreme, Peter Rice, adds his magic later. And that is why we are acknowledged globally as the world's best-sounding podcast. So from me, Conal O'Moran, buíochas to you all, agus slán tamach.